From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. African-American leaders forged in the civil rights movement embraced the identity of being a black leader. Race defined their political agenda and their campaign appeal. But bit by bit, race has become a less welcome label, something to be cast off in favor of more centrist concerns to win a mainstream middle-class vote. In this hour, a new generation of black leaders drops the black label. But first, President Bush met today with key congressional leaders to make his case for military action in Iraq. With confusion and dissent growing, the president laid out his concerns and promised to consult the full Congress before going to war. Earlier, I spoke with David Sanger, White House correspondent for the New York Times. I asked him what was at the heart of the president's message to congressional leaders today.
I think the main message today, Tom, was that the president is going to seek the approval of the Congress before he acts against Iraq. Now, to do so, he is relying on two time-honored techniques. The first is he says he wants to get a vote together, or the White House indicated he wants to get a vote together before the election. Mm-hmm. A subtle challenge that basically goes like this. If you think you want to declare that you're on the side of Saddam Hussein, please do it before voters cast their ballots.
And what kind of vote are we talking about, David?
Well, that's the second part, Tom, and it's interesting. I have never heard this Bush White House refer so often or so glowingly to the era of Bill Clinton. Remember him? Usually anything that happened in the Clinton era is never mentioned in the White House press room. Today they were rolling out the 1998 resolution in which Congress passed and Clinton signed, calling for regime change in Iraq. And fundamentally, I think they want nothing more than what Congress voted for and approved in 1998, except this time it's in an atmosphere where we may actually do something about it.
Is the idea that that would constitute a declaration of war? Was the White House conceding that they need such a declaration?
They were not conceding they need a declaration of war. All they were doing was conceding that they need some kind of signal of approval from Congress. It conceivably might not even mention Iraq. It might give the president the right to go defend the United States against any imminent threat of a state acquiring weapons of mass destruction that could fall into the hands of terrorists. And you spell that R-I-A-Q in the Bush White House's view.
How did the leaders that President Bush met with today receive this initiative?
I think they were just happy to be part of the debate, and I think the actual debate itself you're going to see unfold over some time as they hold hearings, as the president goes to the U.N. next week and makes his case.
David Sanger, what agendas do you see the congressional leaders bringing into the White House? Are the Republicans, in their hesitation, actually opposed to war with Iraq, or simply saying to the president, you've got to make a clearer case?
I think that it's twofold. The first is, and this goes beyond the partisan politics of Democrats and Republicans, Congress is very careful about its prerogatives, and one of its prerogatives in the Constitution is the right to declare war. And so even if it isn't a formal declaration of war, they don't want to set a precedent in which any president can go around them. The second issue, and I think equally important for them, is that they want to think through and force the administration to think through not the invasion of Iraq itself, which I think most of them feel the U.S. military is eminently capable of doing, but what happens on day two and day three and year two and year three, because countries that you invade, you tend to own. And Iraq is not a natural nation. It is not one that is easy to govern. It is not one that we would have any reason to believe would be as easy to govern as Afghanistan. And we've all learned in the past 6 months that's no particularly easy task.
What does today's conversation tell us, if anything, about U.N. inspections in advance of an invasion of Iraq looking for weapons of mass destruction? What does it tell us about Washington's view of the need or the opposite of a U.N. Security Council resolution endorsing a move against Baghdad?
The White House has not said what the president will do on in either case. We expect that we'll hear from him on this issue on September 12th, and I talked to a number of White House officials today who were not giving any quarter on this, and of course the president's speech that day is still being drafted. The body language would lead you to believe that in fact they are heading toward a situation in which they want to probably force one more inspection regime, but under such incredibly tight and coercive conditions that they expect that Saddam will fail it. That is to say, the inspectors will come in. You have a number of days to open up to them, not weeks or months. If they aren't allowed to see a particular building, a particular site, go any place they want, whenever mm-hmm. they want, it will be enforced militarily.
So that's the rough and tough form of inspections. Don't they need the UN to lay hands on any inspection plan?
The advantage of having the UN lay hands on an inspection plan, of course, is that it's a way of building international support for whatever you do. Again, what they're going to argue is this is the inspection plan, and beyond that, this is the commitment to destroy the weapons that Iraq made with the UN at the end of the mm-hmm. Gulf War. And all we're seeking to do is enforce the terms of that ceasefire. We are asking for nothing new. Now, of course, that's lapsed over the past number of years, and so what they've got to go press is their case that there is something urgent now that means that they have to do it immediately. And that may call upon them to reveal some new evidence. We're not sure they have any.
David Sanger, summing up, do you think today's meeting with congressional leaders means that President Bush has turned some corner with Congress? Are we going to have Congress on board now, and does it mean we're on our way to war?
It certainly means that he recognizes this debate had been getting out of his control, and he needs to bring it back into his control. I think he can make a reasonable case that will persuade Congress. Whether he can make that case to the UN is another issue. And that's why I think you've only heard about Congress and not about the harder issue of the United Nations.
David Sanger, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
David Sanger is White House correspondent for the New York Times. He spoke with us earlier today from Washington. With Andrew Cuomo suddenly out of the running, Democrat Carl McCall is lined up to be the first major party African-American candidate in history to run for governor of New York. And former Dallas Mayor Ron Kirk appears to have a real shot at being elected the first black U.S. senator from Texas. A new generation of African-Americans is pushing past the stereotypes of what it means to be a black leader. Forget about ultra-liberal, anti-business, pro-labor cliches. A new wave of black politicians is wooing middle-class voters as new Democrats and as Ivy League grads with more moderate agendas, winning over a mainstream vote and high-profile elections. Is this the triumph at last of the American melting pot? Or as emerging black leaders shed the race label, are the issues that matter to their black constituents falling by the wayside? Where does race fit into the political conversation today? Does it still matter? Are black candidates selling out when they adopt mainstream politics or just doing what it takes to win? You can join our conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us now is Ronald Walters, director of the African American Leadership Institute at the University of Maryland. He served as deputy campaign manager for the 1984 Jesse Jackson campaign for president. Good evening and welcome, Ronald Walters.
Good to be with you.
It's great to have you. Also with us in the studio tonight is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor of the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Hello, Jack. Good to
Hello,
have you
Tom.
Here.
Hello, Mr. Walters.
Hi.
Ron Walters, we've all been reading about this new trend in how successful black politicians are presenting themselves to the electorate, not so much as black leaders, but as leaders, as American leaders. What's the promise here? What's the promise of this new positioning?
Well, I think that, first of all, I think we shouldn't really overstate the case, and I think that's a lot of what is going on here. We have, in this election cycle, the largest number of blacks running for statewide office in history of the country. And in order for blacks to do that, they have to present themselves really like any other politician, white, green, or gray.
Mm-hmm.
They can't afford to carry a sort of a race politics into for example, a race for governor of a state.
But isn't exactly that's the case that's being made, isn't it? I'm sorry, Ron Walters. Isn't that the case that's being made, that exactly that readiness to drop that labeling is what's new?
No, it's not new. I started to say, if you go back to Doug Wilder's campaign for governor of the state of Virginia,
mm-hmm.
You won't find any racial rhetoric in his campaign. And I followed that campaign very closely. I was on the floor of the hotel when he was elected that night. And as a matter of fact, I said to anybody who would listen, who interviewed me, that Doug Wilder was not and could not afford to be a black governor of the state of Virginia. And that even more, it was questionable to me whether or not blacks would benefit all that much simply from Doug Wilder's race.
Because?
Primarily because he had to govern in the interest of all citizens of Virginia, and the black population wasn't but 17% of the total.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So given that, he had to practice a politics that comported with his constituency. And really, I think that's what we are seeing in these other races, to the extent that someone runs for the Senate of the United States from a given state. Politics 101 says that they have to shape their campaign and their issue messages and even their personal identity according to the people that they're going to represent. So that in that sense, it is, I think, somewhat erroneous in your lead-in to say that they are changing their identity. Would that be a complication for their constituents? Because their constituents are only minimally black in most cases.
Ron Walters, it may be that you know these races so well and so intimately and have been so involved for so long that what's Politics 101 to you may be something new to us, and we're prepared to look back over a long scope here and see how this has come. But the stereotype has remained alive, I think, in America of black leaders as positioning themselves as black leaders. And you point out races where that hasn't been the case for some time. Where do you see the most active races now where black politicians are following their constituencies, as you say, right over race lines? What's going on today?
The main one, of course, is when you look at Ron Kirk in Texas, which is really the highest profile black statewide race, I think, that we have.
Mm-hmm.
And the other, of course, is Carl McCall in the state of New York. You won't find Carl McCall, who is a longtime politician in the state of New York, using racial rhetoric. There is something there that is common, I think, in all of these races, which is to say that black voters are sophisticated enough to understand mm-hmm. that's not something that these guys can do. They can't appeal to them on racial grounds. And yet they know that if they get elected, that in some ways, even though having appealed to them in racial terms, it's going to be a plus to them to some extent. So that's what I think we're seeing. We're seeing an uncommon number of blacks running for statewide office, dropping sort of the racial label because they have to. You won't see that, for example, for blacks running in congressional districts. You won't see it in blacks running for mayor, where there is a significant black constituency.
Mm-hmm.
You certainly won't see it in the civil rights field, where there is a presumption that black leaders will represent black constituencies. So in none of these other levels will you see this reputed transformation.
Jack Beatty, join us here. I guess it's in part exactly these instances that Ron Walters points to, Ron Kirk in Texas and Carl McCall in New York, that give such a high profile to what's going on here. Ron Kirk has been the black mayor of Dallas and may be the first U.S. senator from Texas. Carl McCall, the first African-American candidate of a major party in the governor's race in New York. These strike us as signal events somehow.
Yes, they do, and partly because of the surprise of Texas, it is the president's home state, and partly because of the centrality of New York State, the Empire State. But, you know, there's a kind of paradigm, I think, that hangs over these races, and I wonder if Mr. Walters will agree, and that is the Tom Bradley paradigm, both in its promise and in its portent. In 1973, Tom Bradley was elected. He was the police commissioner of Los Angeles, and he was elected mayor in one of the first sort of multiracial coalition elections of black mayors in modern time. And he ran very strongly supported on the west side of L.A. and very strongly supported by Jewish American voters. And this was Tom Bradley ruled for mayor for 20 years. Then he tried to run in midway there. He tried to run for governor. And he ran up against the other side of this, that there was just a residuum of voters out there who would not vote for a black candidate. And something like 10% of them, and that what they had told the pollsters was very different from what happened on election day.
We've got to take a break. We'll come back and look at exactly that instance. We're talking tonight about a new generation of black politicians who don't label themselves black leaders. Are we moving beyond race in the political arena in America? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about a new generation of black politicians who don't label themselves black leaders. Is it time for black politicians to drop the black leader label? Is it long dropped already? Have we left the era of race politics behind? Have we really? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Our guest tonight is Ronald Walters, joining us from Washington, D.C. He's director of the African American Leadership Institute at the University of Maryland. Ron Walters, Jack Beatty has just raised the case of Tom Bradley, the popular Los Angeles mayor who went for statewide office in California and lost, and is seen to have run into a kind of white racist residuum there that was just irreducible. Is this a floating iceberg that black politicians still risk running into as they move deeper into the mainstream going after votes?
Yes, I think Tom has raised a really very interesting question, and that is a question really has dogged blacks trying to run for offices beyond sort of black constituencies, and that is to what extent will they be supported by whites? We know that, for example, some blacks have been supported by whites. That's nothing new. We have about, I would imagine, 10% of the Congressional Black Caucus right now. Represent districts that are not majority black. So on some level, whites do vote for blacks. The difficulty has always been in the very high-profile statewide races, and it's been difficult in some of those cases for blacks to break into the Senate, for example, which is the bastion right now that we know it is, with no blacks there. Mm-hmm. And so it's been difficult to do that. I was thinking of Alan Wheat. His race in Missouri several years ago. Alan Wheat had been a member of the Congressional Black Caucus for a decade and had represented a majority white district in the state of Missouri, a border state, relatively conservative. And when he ran for our Senate, he didn't get but one county, and that was the one he traditionally represented. Same thing with Andy Young, a very popular mayor of the city of Atlanta. Ran for Senate from that city and was soundly defeated. So it's a difficult thing that people like Kirk, and I don't want to forget Dan Blue in North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
It's a difficult act that they have to try to run for a statewide office and to appeal beyond their blackness to white voters. And the question is really, what do you really have to do in order to be successful in doing that?
And we see a lot of people trying to do just that. Ron Walters, Jack Beatty, standby. I want to welcome into our conversation James Traub. He's a journalist. He has an article coming out in this Sunday's New York Times Magazine that goes exactly at this issue of what he calls the last color line. Good evening and welcome, James Traub.
Good evening.
Jim Traub, you write that what we all know, that our political culture has been for much of the last decades dominated by issues of race. But you say that as the second national election of the new millennium approaches, black political culture seems to be moving further and further from an adversarial, race-conscious model. What's the evidence in your mind, and what's the consequence?
Well, so let's talk about those two things separately. The evidence would be candidates like Ron Kirk, who's very, very consciously running in a kind of what I call a non-race-specific way. He doesn't want to be identified as a historic candidate.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, was the mayor of a terribly conservative Republican city, Dallas. You have someone like Carl McCall, who is certainly to the right of the fellow he was running against, Andrew Cuomo, and is a very sort of corporate figure. You have a number of moderate black congressional candidates who defeated more traditionalist and, I guess you'd say, less moderate black candidates in primaries, one in Georgia and one in Alabama. You have figures like Cory Booker, who ran and lost against Sharp James, the mayor of Newark, a younger and more, you might even say, moderate to conservative candidate. I think you have this phenomenon, I would say, both in politics and probably also in black intellectual life. You also have a new generation of more race-neutral, if that's the right word, black academics as well, also of that younger generation.
Let's talk about consequences then. If you see this phenom becoming more and more evident, and you, as I hear you, James Traub, you're even describing a situation where in appealing to a broader constituency,
moderate black leaders may drive out more race-oriented or black-identifying leaders.
Yeah, you know, we don't know yet if that will be so, but I would say, yes, that the traditional black leadership came out of the activist community, out of the civil rights community, out of the pulpit. And many of these fellows, the new class of people, are professionals. They come out of a corporate world or they're lawyers or something like that, and they have a different take on things. And it would be surprising if there weren't a generational change in black leadership. And again, as I say, both among intellectuals and among politicians. So I think that's true. Now, the question is, what are the consequences of that? Well, one might be that it would increase the likelihood of black candidates being elected in majority white areas. Ron Walters is right that among senatorial candidates, this has proved almost impossible, though it certainly has not proved impossible. For mayoral candidates, congressional candidates, and certainly in the case of Douglas Wilder, the former governor of Virginia, you'd say gubernatorial candidates.
Mm-hmm.
It also may have a consequence for the politics of the Democratic Party, which has been so riven, I think, between its own left and its own right or center. And I think maybe a less adversarial racial politics would perhaps heal some of the rifts inside the Democratic Party, which surely would be a good thing for the party.
Listeners, we're talking tonight about black politicians who don't label themselves black leaders. Ron Walters says it's something that's been percolating for a long time. James Traub says it's really breaking out right now. What do you think? Are we moving beyond race in the U.S. political arena? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Garrett's on the line. Hi, Garrett. You're on the air.
Hi. I had a question. You talk about black politics as though there's just one division, but I would also imagine there's a division between the upper classes and the lower classes, and I wonder how that played a role.
And you mean within the black community itself?
That's correct.
Ron Walters, how about it? It's an obvious question. As black candidates move to a multiracial appeal more and more, are they moving to the upper tier of the black community?
Well no, because as I said, and I'll say again, there isn't any evidence at the level of mayor or congressional districts that black politicians are moving toward a non-racial politics. If you mean by non-racial, a politics which moves away from an appeal to their own constituency, that's mm-hmm. simply not going to happen. There's a lot of wishful thinking here.
The question of class, though,
is an important question because there is an element of class politics. In the demographics of the last, certainly the last two decades, we have seen a very strong movement of a black middle class out of many of the major cities. And there is some evidence that they have a far more moderate, certainly a significantly more moderate stance on some issues. I think Mr. Traub talked about McKinney and the Hilliard race in Alabama, mm-hmm. McKinney
and Georgia.
Those two races that were just concluded, those races are not a function of what we're talking about necessarily. They really are a function of outside money coming into those districts and making challengers far more viable than they would have been ordinarily.
Ron Walters, I want to hold those two cases for just a moment and give James Traub.
Could I just finish that point? Because I think that where I was going was to sort of agree with him that when you look at both races, even given the fact that you had outside money, the failure of the black middle class to turn out as strongly as it did also contributed to the loss of both of those candidates.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Garrett, thanks for your question and your call. James Traub, to this central question of how new a thing are we talking about here and how deep is the evidence of a change, Ron Walters says, look, this is the extent it's going on, it's been going on for a while, and when you get to the local level, it's not going on. Is there a significant change here in the way black politicians are presenting themselves to the American electorate?
Well, look, I suppose what I was writing about are straws in the wind. So can I say this constitutes the fundamental new trend? No, I mean, certainly if you look at the members of the Congressional Black Caucus, I don't think their politics are terribly different from what they were 10 years ago or 20 years ago, perhaps more moderate as the Democratic Party is generally. But I certainly do think you have any number of examples of something which looks like a new phenomenon. And so I think what you're seeing maybe is the leading edge of change as this new generation comes to the fore. And as Ron Walters said, as the black middle class grows, becomes a more sizable part of the black electorate, and as its own candidates are the ones who begin to run. So I think one answer, by the way, to the previous questioner's question is perhaps a consequence of this would be a more class-based and less particularly race-based politics, which again would be something that might alter the nature of the Democratic Party to some extent.
Jack Beatty, here we are looking at reading the tea leaves about how all this is unfolding. At one level, arguing about the extent to which it's happening. At another level, there's something irresistible about the notion that it's happening. Maybe we're following that too far.
Maybe so. Just a couple of things, not immediately responsive to that, but I'll get to it. According to an article and some research in the current issue of the American Prospect magazine, Cynthia McKinney actually carried the more affluent black precincts, and the writer says think mansions, golf courses, and Lexus SUVs. They backed her by a 2-to-1 margin.
This is outside Atlanta.
That's right. That's right. So she was actually doing very well among affluent blacks, contrary to the notion that somehow she was putting them off. The decisive thing in that race, of course, as Mr. Walters says, was partly outside money, but partly, too, that 35,000 Republicans crossed party lines and voted in the race and were able to put her out of office. But, you know, we are hopeful about it, and everybody thinks it's great that we should have look at the content of the character of candidates rather than their color. But we had Glenn Lowry, the black economist, on this program a couple of weeks ago, and he made the clear point that just because the civil rights are in the law, by no means does that mean that the problems of black America have been transcended. And he said in some ways, because they're social and economic and because they deal less with matters of right than with matters of stigma, a stigma put on by whites onto blacks, he says they may even be tougher to get at. And one fear, I guess, of candidates, sort of telling white voters what they want to hear, which is, hey, civil rights are there, things are great, we're moving ahead, is that this problem that Glenn Lowry talks about of just, stigma and post-civil rights problems of specifically black Americans will go unaddressed by black leaders.
Well, James Trump, how about that when you look out at the races you cite?
I certainly said or think nothing of the sort. Mm-hmm. That is, to say that candidates are focusing less on specifically racial themes means something more like they talk in a different tone of voice about the issues which are of fundamental importance to both to black voters and to working class and poor voters generally, like crime, drugs, welfare, and things like that. So the point is hardly that we have a new generation of black candidates who are indifferent to the concerns of their own constituents, or let's say of blacks and the disadvantaged generally. No, it's rather they talk about it in a different tone of voice. Maybe they take different stands on the issues. There's a good reason why none of these folks feel remotely comfortable with the Bush administration, including Glenn Lowry. None of their politics, or at least not of the folks I'm familiar with, jibe with that of this administration. There is, I think, an almost consensual belief that without an activist state, the social problems of this country cannot be solved. So that's not what it's about.
And yet, you see them reaching out across a lot of lines, meaning that they're feeling a resonance with that message that goes beyond the black community. James is calling from Eau Claire, Wisconsin. Hi, James. You're on the air.
Hey, how are you folks doing tonight?
Very well, thanks.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'd like to say that I think it's a great thing that we have a black American, and I want to just say an American, running for an office. I think when we place stigma on folks by saying black, white, or as we were saying earlier, gray, it just brings out the more fact that, hey, it's something different. And in lieu of looking at it as a way of labeling, maybe we should look at it as a way of culture or ethnic background, bringing something unique to the table.
But have we come to the place, James, where we can ignore race? Isn't it still a factor?
Yeah, well, I'm in the Navy, and I've worked for many a great American from different races, everything from Filipino to white, black, from all over the world. And in the military, I mean, we have, I guess you could say, a society in which may not be perfect all the time, but we do reap the benefits from a wide diversity of leaders, such as we see on TV. Mr. Powell has done a wonderful job, and he's definitely stepped out. And if the folks down in Texas are looking at running for office, I think it's a great thing.
James, we've got
the right man to do the right job.
We've got you loud and clear. Thank you for your call, Ron Walters. How about it? Have we come closer to this melting pot ideal that you can hear the yearning for in James' call, where race is really a backseat issue?
No. I think that that won't happen until the socioeconomic condition of blacks changes far more substantially than it has. The reason for that, of course, is that race, and I certainly agree with Mr. Traub about this, race is often a synonym for socioeconomic issues. And the fact that the black population is configured in the way that it is where the agenda for its leadership comes from, where the style of its leaders come from. So that really is the fundamental thing. You won't find in any community, black or white, the style and the substance of the leadership differing from what the constituent feels about its condition. It simply won't happen. And so that law is the same thing in the black community. If you change the constituent's condition, then the leadership has to follow.
But what about when the constituent...
It's not the other way around, which is the leadership changes and then the constituents follow.
Understood.
Which is what we seem to be saying.
Well, what...
Now, final point I would make about that is that I think we really do have to segregate the people who are running for legislative offices from civil rights leaders. And the reason for that is that there's so much of their legislative agenda is a racially oriented agenda. But you don't hear the rhetoric of race in these parliamentary bodies. When you go outside those institutions and you look at people in the street, the leadership is far freer to address terms of race in fairly direct ways that leaders in parliamentary bodies are not. So I think that we have to look at the various environments and within which leadership takes place as well.
No doubt, Jack Bedia. I wonder, as we see this evolution, and it's not monolithic, as Ron Walters points out to us very clearly, but the view from the civil rights era, when political leaders and community leaders and civil rights leaders were not all that different, I wonder how it looks from that vantage.
Yeah, a sort of changing in of idiom, really, to meet new circumstances. Well, we don't know. What worries me, and I just to repeat, is that Tom Bradley notion and the problem, the big question about statewide races with black candidates. We've seen it too often, and I think that's one of the things we're going to see in this election. Let's test that hypothesis.
We'll come back and do exactly that. We're talking tonight about black politicians and labels and race. Are we moving beyond race, even a little, in the political arena? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about black politicians navigating multiracial constituencies. And the question is, must black aspirants for political office in the United States today go mainstream to survive and thrive? Should they? At what level in politics do they? Are we moving beyond race in the political arena? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined tonight by Ron Walters. He's director of the African American Leadership Institute at the University of Maryland, and by James Traub. His article, The Last Color Line, will appear in this Sunday's edition of the New York Times Sunday Magazine. Also joined right now on the line by Daryl. Welcome, Daryl. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I have two comments and then a question.
Mm-hmm.
My first comment is that really this whole idea of black leadership or black leaders per se, I think, is a term that's it's been manufactured by really the white-dominated media, and I think that sort of flavors the conversation.
Hmm.
And my second comment is that, and I think it's similar to what Mr. Walters talked about earlier, was that the difference between the context between leaders of civil rights organizations versus folks who are politicians.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And my question is, how is this situation different or similar to the 70s and 80s when we had, like, I think it was Stokes in Cleveland, Coleman Young in Detroit, Harold Washington in Chicago. What's the difference? What is different from now?
Looking back to those years, Daryl, it's a great question. Ron Walters, let me put it next to you. Let's put the eras side by side. How's the contrast look?
Well, I think that the contrast is pretty close at the level of mayors, except that I think when you look at some of the mayors, places like Detroit and some of the other cities, you find a difference primarily because of the condition of cities has deteriorated over the course of the last two decades.
Mm-hmm.
And so the mayors have had to adopt a far more moderate politics in order to bring business leaders back into the city in order to appeal for resources from governors and the like.
Mm-hmm.
And so you see some changes in the mayors, primarily not because, again, of simply they wanted to change their style because race was not that persuasive. But, again, having to appeal to the hard conditions of their constituents
mm-hmm.
And the environment of their cities. It seems to me that when you look at the Bradley syndrome, that really raises a very interesting question here. Because,
how so?
Well, primarily because we've talked a lot about blacks, but black leaders and black leadership really mm-hmm. is a function of the challenges put to blacks by whites. The question really becomes, when whites change, then I think blacks will be able to get beyond race.
Change in the acknowledgement of problems on the ground? Change in what dimension?
Oh, when it changes, yeah, when the attitude of whites results in changing situations on the ground. But before that, you're not going to have much change in leadership. I mean, if you just look at the Million Man March, you look thousands of people here in Washington, D.C. the other day talking about reparations, and I went out there. You want to look at the younger generation, there they were.
Mm-hmm.
They think that they are responding to challenges that the society has brought to them. And so their leadership is not going to change, and the people that they appeal to for leadership is not going to change until what they see in society actually changes. The attitude of society changes toward them. When that happens, then the leadership will have a mandate to really change.
Daryl, thank you for your call. James Traub, we read Jesse Jackson quote in the Washington Post just last week saying, black is used not to describe us, but to define us and therefore confine us. Vintage Jesse Jackson. But the idea is strong there. What do you make of Daryl's point that the whole idea of black leadership is a white media creation?
Well, I would turn it maybe in a different direction. I mean, I don't know what it means to say it's a white media creation. Clearly, there has been a yearning for powerful, morally compelling figures in the black community, and not only in the black community. The civil rights struggle produced that. There is an article, in the current issue of City Journal, which is a quarterly of urban issues and a decidedly conservative bent.
Mm.
An article by a black author named John McWhorter, who's a professor at Berkeley, who says there's this yearning for the Martin Luther King figure and the waiting for when that figure will return.
Mm.
And that figure won't return because the moment no longer requires it. That is to say, the moment no longer requires the kind of a morally impassioned, crusading leadership that even in a debased form, a Marion Barry was offering to the voters of Washington. Now, the voters of Washington, who obviously are overwhelmingly black, seem poised to reelect Anthony Williams, who is a technocrat, but a man who basically says, I'll pick up the garbage, I'll make the trains run on time. So I wonder if, in fact, there isn't some kind of change in temperature that changes the kind of leadership that, in fact, people are seeking.
Ron Walters?
I think that the other thing that I always trot out is something that I think we have to take into consideration, especially given Washington, D.C., and that is the structure of choice. If you've got a Williams who's really, I think, turned off a very substantial segment of the black population, but nevertheless is the best you've got, and you look at some of the other candidates, Then I think, yeah, the normal person would come to the conclusion that you got to vote for Williams.
Mm-hmm. Because in, that's in the mayoral race in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, because that's the structure of choice. Mm-hmm. And so
figures like Dennis Archer, who clearly also are quite moderate figures, there have been a number of
that's the same evaluation I would make. And that as Dennis Archer comes along and he presents himself as, you know, someone who I think can do it. But the structure of choice doesn't yield anybody else.
Ron Walters,
you go from a Dennis Archer now to a young man who people elected because they think he will sort of bring politics back to the black community, in matter of fact, two communities in particular.
Ron Walters, Jim Traub, please stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation Bakary Kitwana. He's author of The Hip-Hop Generation, Young Blacks and the Crisis in African-American Culture. Good evening and welcome, Bakary Kitwana.
Good evening. Thank you.
Thanks for being with us. You've written about the very young end of the community and what you describe as a crisis in that culture. How does that intersect with the political trends we're talking about tonight?
Well, I think for what you're speaking about tonight, I think the starting point for any discussion of black politics has to be the issues that matter to black voters. I think that much of what's been discussed has been the black politicians, which I think, as Ron Walters pointed out, is just one aspect of black politics. You also have to consider the activists. You also have to consider the intellectual leadership. And more importantly, I think you also have to consider those people who are not voting. And in many cases, the issues, people aren't voting because the issues don't appeal to them. When you're talking about this younger generation that I'm speaking about in my book, The Hip-Hop Generation, I'm talking about an emerging voting bloc of African-Americans, many of whom have not voted in the past because the issues that are on the table have not appealed to them.
So this is interesting then, Bakary Kitwana. What about when that rising segment of the potentially voting public looks at politicians like Ron Kirk and Carl McCall, black politicians who are appealing right across racial lines, across many lines, because they're looking for statewide office? Does it create a disconnect when these leaders move up out of the black community so far and are addressing issues that go across so many lines? Do they still speak to a core constituency?
I think they do on some levels, but I think they don't speak strongly enough. I think that the problem, again, is that the political process and the issues on the table have become more conservative, and the fact that the politicians are doing so to appeal to constituencies is a part of that. And so what I'm call for in the book is for young people to get more involved in the mainstream political process to make politicians accountable to their issues. And one of the things that I think have been a problem for blacks in the political process and for black politicians has been the some of the voids in terms of like black political organizations and black individuals helping to fund black political candidates. So many times their constituency and their responsibility are to those who help to get them into office, and often that isn't African-Americans.
If the vote's not there, the clout is not there. Bakary Kitwana, thanks for being with us for a few minutes tonight. Much appreciated.
Thank you.
Jack Beatty, I guess that the point that Bakary Kitwana raises goes exactly to this issue of whether Ron Kirk-style candidates or Carl McCall who step way beyond race identification. They're clearly black politicians, but they're appealing to a much wider electorate than that, risk somehow floating up above a racially identified community that needs their support.
Well, yeah, that's the question I was trying to raise earlier, and I think I did it perhaps crudely. I don't necessarily mean that I was disagreeing with Mr. Traub. But you do have to wonder about that simply because of the nature of the funding in American politics, how important that is to get people elected. And we know from all other signs that money is what rules on Capitol Hill and secondarily, I suppose, in state houses. And you have to wonder about divergence of issues. You know, a governor, for example, dealing with the issue of a metropolitan possible solution to, well, the Supreme Court makes that difficult mandatorily, but trying to encourage some sort of metropolitan solution to problems of segregated schools. I mean, that sets the white suburban constituency against the core black constituency. You can imagine minimum wage cleavages. You can imagine cleavages over housing. And I think, Yeah, I think that that divergence between the funders and the people is a paradigm of course, the diversions within the Democratic Party. Its funders and its voters are different people.
I want to try and get one more call in. Ted is on the line. Hi, Ted. You're on the air.
Hi. I'd just like to talk about an election in Denver that I was an intern on. It was Wellington Webb's reelection campaign.
Yes, for mayor of Denver.
Exactly, the mayor of Denver, exactly. It was his first reelection campaign. He ran against in the runoff against a city councilwoman from the southeast part of town, which is predominantly white and upper middle class.
So this is Wellington Webb, a black candidate against a white opponent.
That's exactly right. Mm-hmm. And the interesting part of the story is that Wellington Webb had a much easier time appealing to the white upper middle class vote than Diane DeGette had appealing to the black community. And at the end of the day, there was a great graphic in the Denver Post that showed Wellington Webb's votes and against Dan DeGette, the councilwoman's, and it turned out that he had the majority of the vote and won all of the traditionally black areas and the Hispanic areas and a percentage of the white areas where she had no impact at all, really, in the black areas of town.
A winning combination, then, for Wellington Webb.
Right, and I think that I guess the point is then, or the question is it easier for a black candidate to cross over than it is for a white candidate to cross over into predominantly
very
black
good
area?
James Traub, what do you say?
Yeah, I mean, you know, we had here in New York City, you know, David Dinkins was our mayor for one term, and when he was running for re-election in 1993, Bill Clinton, then incumbent president, came in and said, David Dinkins is in danger of losing because white people are unwilling to vote for a black candidate. The man was the incumbent. He had already won in 1989. And he wound up offending large numbers of white voters, I think, who had voted quite happily for Dinkins in 89 and weren't going to vote for him again in 93, not because they had changed their feelings about race, but because they had changed their feelings about Dinkins. So certainly we have that and other examples where a moderate black candidates get sizable white votes. And it is true, in fact, that it's very difficult. There must be cases, but I don't know about them, where white candidates have polled sizable black votes running against a black candidate. But such is the nature of racial solidarity in voting that I imagine is quite unusual.
Ron Walters, we've only got 40 seconds left, but that sounds like it describes an opportunity for black candidates to reach well beyond a black voting base and build real power.
Well, yeah, but again, it depends upon what level they're running. You had a race, mayor's race in Philadelphia very recently where you had a young black male running against a white female. And she did very well. As a matter of fact, she won the race primarily because she's known to have delivered in the black community. So I would say really the answer to that question is that it depends. Final thing I would say is that the question here of symbols, I think, are very important in appealing to blacks, where you really can't use a sort of a straight racial dialogue and rhetoric. We've had a lot of first blacks running for office. That symbol of a first black has carried a lot of blacks over the line and with blacks, even though they couldn't even use racial rhetoric.
Ron Walters, with that, we're out of time, but thanks for joining us tonight. It's been great having you. Ron Walters is director of the African American Leadership Institute at the University of Maryland. And James Traub, whose article, The Last Color Line, appears in the Sunday New York Times Magazine this weekend. Thank you for being with us.
Well, thanks very much.
Jack, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Click on On Point Radio, forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR, Burfund.